Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. This is Leo. I'm sorry that sorry I started late. We had severe thunderstorms here and afraid to turn on my computer. I still am, actually. Hold on one second here. I'm trying to get organized a little. Yeah, very severe thunderstorms. It's been blue. Hail, big hailstorms. Excuse me one second. I'm just trying to write down my number in case Blog Talk Radio number. And because it's Blog Talk's kind of hooked up to the phone system, so if the phone goes out, I'm out. But if it doesn't, then I can call back in. But anyway, what I wanted to discuss tonight was I was going to read a section from works from Manly P. Hall. In it, he talks about, he talks quite a bit about a lot of things, but citizens, I like this, the sound of this one, and I thought you might as well. It's called The Citizens of the Cosmic Commonwealth. Accepting the leadership of the divine will. Interesting. And then, of course, Manly P. Hall. This was copyrighted in 1972. Lecture 161 from his series. If you followed any of the other ones that I've done on Manly Hall, I think... you'll get some kind of perspective on the knowledge this man had of so many things, especially Egyptian, Eastern philosophy, if I sound pensive, it's just because there is a serious thunderstorm going on here tonight. We had hail the size of golf balls there for a while. There's still the flooding out there as I'm reading. So, not much I can do but stand right here. The lightning seems to have gone away, but the incredible amount of rain. Watching my front yard, flow away here. Unbelievable. But anyway, let's forget that for now. Yeah, this is a night of spirituality, not one of reality. Surviving a great northeastern summer storm flood. So, but anyway, let me go on here with this. This is called The Citizens of the Cosmic Commonwealth and Accepting the Leadership of the Divine Will. For many thousands of years, human beings have dreamed of an equitable physical social institution. Very long ago, efforts were made to actually create social commonwealths that were suitable to the essential needs of man. But the needs for such commonwealths have changed through the ages, and most of the utopian dreams of the past would not be satisfactory today. They are largely conservative and bound by various religious considerations and were applicable to societies no longer in existence. Still, however, we are faced by this need for some type of workable government throughout the world that will ensure some type of that will ensure maximum security for the individual and give to the various members of his social group the rights and privileges of that security. But with these rights are inherent responsibilities we must never forget. One factor that is distinguished in nearly all ancient utopian schemes is this requirement for personal responsibility. Sir Thomas More's utopia was not a blessed land of idleness. Every practical utopia from Tommaso Campanella's City of the Sun to Francis Bacon's New Atlantis, including also the Platonopolis, of Platonius and J.V. Andres Christianopoulos were institutions of cooperation and mutual support. We know that the trade unions and guilds that developed in the Middle Ages bestowed benefits upon the members in relationship to the contributions which the members made to the excellence of this community. It was not the payment of dues which provided preference, it was the outstanding achievement of skill within his own group. We know also that for a very long time human beings have recognized the importance of developing ways of using natural resources without abusing them. S. Gould's Nova Sulima, one of the greatest utopias of the 17th century, emphasized strongly man's cooperation with nature. The isolated hero cycle, which centers around a marooned man such as Robinson Crusoe and his experience on some island, also contains the philosophy that man must cooperate with nature for the attainment of a better world. Yet man's leadership in nature cannot be taken for granted. The alchemists, the illuminists, the Rosicrucians, the members of various societies surrounding such concepts as those found in Boccalini's A General Reformation of the World, accepted a leadership in nature with reverence. Humanity has the potential of being nature's administrator, executor, and willing cooperator in the divine plan. It has everything at hand to be this willing cooperator, yet it has to be the present time neglected this awesome privilege and has abused its rights. As a result of this failure to cooperate, man has continued from generation to generation, perpetrating miseries that are not essential. Yet this perpetration, this perpetuation, will not be interrupted unless the individual accepts his responsibilities as a citizen of nature. Nature gives man many benefits and blessings, yet in reality we are more than beholden to nature. We depend upon nature for our very survival. We could not last even for a few seconds without the continued benevolence of a very skillfully developed and administered universal system. Yet we have become so accustomed to our privileges that we have taken them for granted and more or less resent our responsibilities. In this we are much like many young people of the present generation who feel that they are entitled to everything, but must not be required to make any modifications in their own conduct. Citizenship in nature demands understanding of nature. Insofar as this is possible, we all know that the ultimate mysteries of life have not yet been generally solved. Only some believe they have all the answers, but there is no general agreement concerning the nature of ultimates, and I think it is best to assume that all knowledge available at the present time is relative rather than absolute. Yet science could give us many insights into the operation of universal purpose, but because of the continuing emphasis upon the exploitation of natural resources for human profit, most scientific research today is largely concerned with amplifying man's privileges. This research, of course, cannot give us an understanding of man's responsibilities to nature and nature's reasonable demands upon the individual that cannot be denied or avoided. As a result of this directed attention, science is not aiding us to discover the ground plan of a universal purpose. In fact, a very large number of scientists would question the reality of the purpose in nature and would admit that they neither knew or cared whether there was such purpose. We would like to assume that man is lord over all he surveys and that it is up to him to bind the universe according to his own desires and ambitions. Well, this assumption has been present for a long time, and it's a continuance has been made possible by the comparatively paucity of population. Up to the last 500 years, there has always been vast areas in which pioneering and further expansion of culture have been possible. We probably would have come to our present crises in the 16th or 17th century had it not been for the opening of the Western Hemisphere. Here was a great area sparsely populated and suitable for colonization. We have gradually reached the end of this type of evasion. We can no longer walk out on we can no longer walk out on congestion. We can no longer scatter to other areas or to distribute more evenly our pollution. We are faced now with the inevitable problem of getting along with ourselves, and most of all, getting along with nature. We are beginning to realize that nature will not change its ways. It either is a friend or an enemy, depending entirely upon how we use or abuse it. A pattern of responsible conduct as energy is emerging at the present time, and the real facts of life are becoming a source of great uneasiness to the polluters and exploiters of natural resource. We have every reason to be worried and concerned about our ecologic future. We despair at some obvious facts, but fortunately nature is not in the business of providing punishment. Its tactics are not Gestapo-like. Nature is benevolent as long as man acts with intelligence. We despair because we realize our selfish and careless past. Nature cannot and will not permit continuous violation of natural law. Finally, our mistakes catch up with us. This is not something that we need face with excessive discouragement or the type of anxiety which can cause a world neurosis, but it is certainly mandatory that we do some clear thinking, and clear thinking nearly always means unselfish thinking. And most persons are frustrated by the fact that no matter how carefully they think, our world conditions remain the same. Actually, few of us are really capable of influencing world conditions, even though we see clearly what requires immediate attention. Nature has always confronted man with this challenge. In the long run, however, nature assists the person who is right and whose actions are coincidental to their own, to her purposes. It is therefore better for a person to form a private partnership with the integrity than it is to say, I can do nothing because others do nothing. A private partnership with nature is not something that nature is likely to overlook. And we have proof of this in practically every science relating to the improvement of man's conditions here, physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual. Even when a person lives in a community which breaks all the rules, he can apply them. Nevertheless, to himself and his own conduct. And consequently, he shall escape many of the ailments which kill, which will be common to others. For there is an inevitable consequence to every action. Every action has its inevitable reaction with certainty that night follows day. The fact that your friends and acquaintances are alcoholics does not demand that you be an alcoholic, nor does it mean that if you refuse this giddy euphoria, nature will punish you for being unsociable. For nature recognizes integrity and reaches down to the smallest living creature to pat it on the head. Symbolically speaking, when it does a good job, man is not a creature who must make the same mistakes as his group. He theoretically has the intelligence to learn from the mistakes of other human beings and has the right to be right at any time. This idea that it will never be noticed and no one will ever care is foolish, for every phase of our lives reveals that we are noted and what we do is carefully considered. Though many fail to the right and many to the left, or rather many fall to the right and to the left, the just man is unmoved and stands straight. This is something we are learning from all departments of science, whether it be biology, psychology, philosophy, or any of the other ologies. So this person who is right is investing in nature and in his own future. This is something we can all do with dividends. Individuals can get into trouble collectively, but most of us have to get out of trouble singularly. We fall into difficulty by doing what everyone else is doing and then have to fight our way out of problems alone. We crawl out of these problems with the aid of personal integrity. And if we are able to escape by our own integrity, it means that we have cooperated with law, not man-made law, but universal law. It may be that a clever lawyer can get us out of some situation in which we should really be punished by man-made laws, but in the presence of a divine law, we need neither a defense nor an accuser. Our own integrities are sufficient. It is requisite that we implement this type of thinking as soon as possible. We live in a world in which too many resources have been exploited and too many mistakes have been made. Resources that have required billions, or perhaps millions, or perhaps billions of years to create, are being wantonly wasted in a matter of a few centuries. And many of these materials approach foreseeable depletion. We are gradually impoverishing our relationship with those natural factors which supply our survival. This does not mean we are in imminent danger or that some horrible catastrophe is inevitable. What it means is that each person must gradually think through the problem of value and his own legitimate requirements, and thinking is why we were put here. We were not born just to suffer, but we're not born to do just as we please. Inevitably, somewhere in the great plan of things, somewhere in the great plans of things, there is an educational factor, and we are here to be educated. Like most children, we resent education without realizing it. At some time long ago, we resented universal law and considered the spiritual government, or whatever the universal hierarchy may be called, as a super establishment. We decided to declare war on it and assert our own authority. And from this assertion of individuality, we have never fully recovered. We want to control and exploit the world at the same time. And gradually science, or rather our own peculiar interpretation of science, have destroyed our capacity for veneration and has replaced it with the equally peculiar attitudes as to how we can best exploit natural resources forever. We allow this exploitation because we do not recognize any mortality other than our own, and therefore we can never be punished for what we do. What we fail to note is the fact that there may well be a built-in morality. Everything we do has its consequences, and these consequences are honest in terms of what we have done. Here we must begin to think a little differently about the future. We must realize that competition is less attractive than cooperation. It may take us another 50 or more years, or 100 years, for this to be obvious, but a world of competitive processes, a world in which individuals are constantly seeking advantage over other individuals, must be replaced with a world of individuals who can work together for mutual assistance. This self-assertiveness is going to be very hard for some people to give up, and some individuals go into a virtual panic at the prospects of cooperation. I talked not long ago with a man who admitted that he didn't wish to live so long as to see this happen. The only fun he had in life was getting something away from someone else. The only fun he had was getting something away from someone else. Well, if he isn't dead by the time this happens, he won't last long afterwards. But how we have developed this attitude is difficult to understand, because we all understand that we live in a universe of limited resources. None of us have a true claim on nature or nature's abundance. They belong finally to the environment in which we exist. They are not ours. We claim that they are ours because we happen to be sitting on them. But after we are gone, another generation will claim them. And 100 generations have claimed them before we arrived. And they and their claim have all gone. Our claims have all gone, yet the resources remain. As far as they survive our own selfishness. The full situation is that our survival depends upon a form of natural supply which we did not invent, which we did not create, and which we have done nothing to protect. In fact, we have done everything we could to waste this generosity of nature. It is really required of us to intelligently plan the use of natural supply in a sense of fairness with all men. It is time for us to think clearly of a different kind of life, for if we do not accept it voluntarily, it will nevertheless come out. One of these days, there isn't going to be any more crude oil with which to make gasoline. It just depends on how fast we use it up. And one of these days, we might find food in short supply, even in this nation of wealth. We will discover that a nation cannot continue to dump its pollution into its water and air without the gravest of consequences, but we still cling to the hope that science will be able to take care of this problem as well. But the difficulty is the trend in science, which we must admit, when science discovers a particularly good solution for something, there are usually few survivors. The scientific process creates too many dangers in itself and usually interferes with the balance of nature. This abundance of technology and industry is creating much of the same situation as excessive medication creates in the body, a poisoning. By treating every ailment, pain, and discomfort with some pill, regardless of their combinational or accumulative effect, we are producing a combustible state that threatens our survival. So all these problems will not be solved by science finding new answers to delay the realization that we cannot misuse with impunity. No matter what science finds, unless man changes, scientific discoveries will move against the good of the individual and against the good of the natural plan of things. So we must begin to think in more serious terms of building the kind of world our grandchildren or perhaps our great-grandchildren will have to live in, a world in which a completely new standard of value is accepted. This necessity will prompt the new renaissance. This is a motion from the old to the new, and we are trying to push the old into the new, but it does not work. We are also trying to run away from the present into the vacuum of undone good, and this will not work. We cannot escape into a future unless we have a reasonable, workable plan for that future. If we do, we merely extend the present into the future. But eventual change is inevitable, and it is inevitable that we do face up to our problems. Change is not inherently bad, nor inherently good, but it is the consequence of action. And for the future, we would hope that man shall outgrow a type of life that is no longer suitable. Also, to be remembered is the fact that the consciousness of man is in evolution. Behavior that was suitable 500 years ago is not now appropriate, even though it is admitted that examples of man's wide past are still very much with us. But the general trend has been one of improvement, and this improvement is breaking through in a number of areas. We are no longer willing to accept as inevitable the ills of the past. We are no longer willing to accept the adage that things must go on as they have in the past. Not long ago, people were still saying, there has always been war, and there will always be war. There are larger numbers of persons today who do not believe that they may be in the minority. They may be in the minority of persons today who do not believe that. but their numbers are still considerable. Unfortunately, however, few have practical solutions for the avoidance of resolutions of conflict, and a few of them are fighting their own private wars over nothing more consequential than the privilege of being able to abuse their bodies with marijuana. They may scream over ecological pollution, but think nothing of polluting their brains. But still, the concept remains that things can be better, problems can be solved, and we are beginning to realize that the reason why our problems have not been solved is because up to now, problems have been profitable. And as long as they remain so, solutions will not be diligently sought. To face this type of responsibility, the individual must begin to work with himself. Many years ago, the gentleman who preceded me as pastor of the Church of the People here in Los Angeles, Mr. Ronald E. Blight, asked a question which seems to me to be rather important. How much is a man worth who has lost everything he has? This is actually a very important question and a very simple answer. He is worth nothing more nor nothing less, for worth is not determined by possessions. What a man owns has nothing necessarily to do with what he is worth in terms of essential value. For a man is worth the investment required to build his present character and integrity. A man is worth his creative skills and what he can contribute to the common good of man, and he is worth the noblest of his own conviction. These are his values. Someday, these will have to become world values. Every great system of religion and every great system of philosophy have pointed out these truths to the only time truths to our attention, but no one has yet been strong enough to apply them. The only time they will be applied is when man realizes that to not apply them is more painful than using and cooperating with these inevitables. But perhaps this is not too far from our present thinking. We must now begin to reorient ourselves in a term of value and be minded that our reason for being here is to become more conscious of universal value, wiser in the use of things for which we are stewardship, and more modest in our demands. We shall depend ever more upon the resources of our internal life for the satisfaction of a career and personal development. To create or assist in something of value is the real reward for effort. With all our living, we must keep faith with the laws governing living, not man-made but universal laws. Let us keep the peace, keep the faith, and keep the principles which are the foundations of construction, social structure, and this peace shall strengthen us in adversity. Revolution is not a satisfactory problem-solving technique, but growth is. No problem for which man is responsible can be commanded away. Only the responsible man can transcend irresponsibility, and each of us must face the areas in which we show least maturity and move toward maturity. We must face it as wisely and as rapidly as situations will permit. This means greater consideration for universal principles, greater attentiveness to these principles. It demands a reorientation in education and sociology. It brings to our attention the fact that the final survival patterns in this pattern of integrity is the pattern of integrity. Any individual who compromises integrity compromises the probability of his own security. He is not injuring any other person to the degree that he is injuring himself. And I just wanted to comment here that I just wanted to mention that for those who are joining us, that we're reading from Manly P. Hall's work, our lecture, the citizens of the cosmic commonwealth, and accepting the leadership of the divine will. All right, Manly P. Hall. He wrote this in 1972, I believe. And the constructive side of all of this also looms clearly on the horizon. Human beings do not enjoy being uncomfortable. We do not want to be permanently miserable. We wish to do whatever we please without consequences. As this formula is proving itself to be unreasonable, it has to be discarded. And the goal of man's existence in an inner security, happiness, and enlightenment, the individual is here to grow, and if he grows gracefully, he will be happy. If he grows only through misery, of course, he will be unhappy and will resent the cost of the enlightenment. But in either case, he will grow in understanding. He has the right to grow with happiness, enjoying his life experiences, and he has the right to be a better person every day because he finds his greatest joy in the surpassing of self. We are surrounded with a vast body of evidence which attests to the divine plan of things. It is our privilege to be able to observe this body of natural phenomena and to realize the course we ourselves must take. We must learn to use natural law as the final criterion for value. No one, not even the most skillful of persons, can go against natural law for any substantial length of time. It may appear that we can break natural law temporarily, but the law which we try to break will ultimately break us. We cannot succeed in defying nature. Nature, however, offers a number of benevolent prospects. There is no reason why a human society, from which a number of major defects have been removed, should not enjoy far greater health, length of life, trust and security for its citizens, and still operate with greater effectiveness. It is as it participates more in nature's program for health, it shall enjoy greater social health. It is not at all unreasonable to assume that with the length of time required for the individual to achieve maturity, he should not be able to continue for another 100 years. This will remain uncommon. However, as long as most of us are breaking the rules and are living in a society which itself breaks the rules, we can, however, correct this rule-breaking tendency. There is no reason why anyone has to remain a neurotic forever. Neuroses may be one of the greatest causes of misery that we have in the world today, but it is not an inevitable nor a necessity. It is a mental sickness that results almost completely from man's inability to understand the laws of his own mind. Not that he does not know what these laws are, which makes him sick, but his emotions and attitudes will not permit him to transcend his own errors. One of our big problems is this necessity to avoid pain and discomfort. We enjoy a Herculean meal and then medicate ourselves to avoid the discomfort from eating too much. We do everything possible to ensure mental fatigue and anxiety and then reach into the medicine cabinet so we can ignore the symptoms of stress. Why do we wonder that we cannot survive successfully on food which has no nutritional value? And why must we sacrifice 50,000 Americans in automobile accidents every year, maiming many times that figure? These are not requirements of nature, and the idea that these things are inevitable because they are part of progress is just stupid. They are not inevitable, and they are not part of progress. They are the inevitable consequence of man's own stupidity and nothing else. But these things can be corrected. There is no reason why we should have the type of crime that is now besetting us. There is no reason why a university professor with a PhD should invite his students to be users of narcotics. He shares the same stupidity with his students who accept his offer. These things are unnecessary. I believe he's talking about Timothy Leary there, and possibly others. Most of the mistakes we make are simply a result of our own immaturity, selfishness, foolishness, and arrogance. And nature does not permit this to continue indefinitely, for if nature did not step in, then the purposes of nature would be damaged. Then we would be in danger of the grand frustration. Nature will keep on pounding on us until we make the necessary corrections. We are also fairly exhausted by international complications. We are tired of boundary lines. We are tired of the perversities and inconsistencies of various administrations all over the world. We are tired of nations that acquire their freedom only to make their own citizens less free 6 months later. These immaturities, personal, national, and international, are not required of nature. They are not some mass of inevitables that have descended from the stars, nor are they requirements of some starry influence. They are actually the result of our own regenerated attitudes. These unregenerate attitudes are leading us to a situation which no one will enjoy. Humanity as a group will rise against these national selfish attitudes, and solutions are going to be considered from a global perspective. And the more enlightened our decisions, the more unselfish our goals, and more likely they will have enduring power. For all solutions are relative and either work with the plans of nature and endure or oppose nature and collapse. I think every one of us should allow a certain portion of this day to make peace with life. And this does not ordinarily require more than a few moments each day. We can do it in various ways, and the various meditational systems of the world might assist us. But here, technique is less important than intent. We will find that if this peacemaking does nothing else, it will begin to make life less expensive. When we make peace with life, it's entirely possible that our doctor bills will be reduced, and even suspect that we will have fewer lawsuits, or rather reduced, and we will be able to throw away all that junk in the medicine cabinet. Those inevitable sorrows and misfortunes which arise from poor decisions will no longer plague us. Religions in the past have tried to help us make that peace with nature, but unfortunately religions are made up of people. Religion is not a sacrosanct group that is isolated from humanity. It is a conviction interpreted by or misinterpreted by millions of people. But basically, religion has given us the Golden Rule and the Ten Commandments, and these basics are verified every day by the conduct of men of goodwill in every land. The Ten Commandments have been more important than any scientific discovery yet made. And without the Ten Commandments, science is capable of creating monsters who turn on their creators. And to have skill without having developed integrity is a fatal situation. So, in concentrating on that for a moment, we have to conclude that there is no that unless we concentrate on the laws of creation, the cosmic laws, the laws, divine laws, well, laws of nature, then we have no then we cannot then we're doomed. Basically, we're doomed to destroy ourselves, or destroy our nation, or destroy our country, or whatever it may be. It's no different than if you overwater your flowers, or, you know, neglect your body, or neglect your mind, or neglect your neighbor. Um, just by keeping your own house in order, you are following cosmic law. Okay. And that's important as far as in, not only in personal relationships, but also in international and governmental relationships. Mind your own affairs. Keep your own house in order, and things will work for you. Plato, Aristotle, Plotinus, Proclus, and this other guy I can't pronounce, all the great Western philosophers with Confucius, Lao Tse, and Buddha have testified that selfishness is man's biggest problem. Perhaps Buddha was one of the most outspoken on this problem, for he was so convinced that human selfishness and human ignorance were the foundation of man's dilemma that he strongly advocated the intelligent person to renounce the entire social and mental structure to which he belonged. There is a slight modification of this view in the latter developments of Buddhism, but it is still a renunciation of worldliness, if not a renunciation of the world itself. But one important point remains constant, and that is that our own minds are the tyrants. Unless we educate our own minds away from selfishness and ambition, there will be no peace in this world, no peace of mind, and no bliss in the world to come. This is very basic, and the proof of this is the fact that when we start to make these corrections, life becomes more interesting and fulfilling. We are working with nature, not against nature. Therefore, we are accepting the responsibility of conduct. We can then realize why minds are given to us. Why minds were given to us, rather, that they might be used. We were not intended to use our minds as perpetual instruments of an adolescent playtime. The mind must grow up and become the protector of the individual and not the exploiter of society. If mind stuff is properly trained, it can accomplish great things, but an undisciplined mind complicates, confuses, and causes the individual to be here, there, and everywhere. And in the days like that lie ahead, one or two points might be of interest. Man must basically develop a workable faith, a faith that is based not upon creedal affiliations, although this is not necessarily wrong, but a faith that is operative. The individual must gradually come to know that there are powers and forces of nature which are dedicated to the good. If we do not assume them to be good, we will have to assume them to be natural. And whether we accept or dislike natural law, we will obey it or suffer. And experience proves to us that natural law is right. When we cooperate with it, we perceive its intelligent working in every part of existence. So we must have a faith. We have to believe sincerely that there is a purpose. We may not know what that purpose is, but we have to believe in it, and we have to believe that this purpose requires us to be honest. If we are honest, this purpose will protect us, and if we are not honest, this purpose will turn against us and punish us. This much religion we have to have. We have to have a faith in the integrity of the total existence to which we belong, and we have to realize that this total existence demands that we keep that faith every day, all the time. If we do not keep this faith, the future of our way of life is assured. If we do keep this faith, the future of our way of life is assured. If we do not keep it, the future lies in an uncertain bog of conflict and confusion. After we once have a faith which makes us stronger to do what we know we must do, we can then learn its intellectual justification, but faith nearly always has to have an emotional impact if it is to be effective. A mental stimulation or a mental systemization does not have sufficient force behind it to bring change in conduct. The principal support of faith in man, however, is experience. Lord Bacon declared that there were three instruments in his instauratio magna for the establishment of knowledge. One is tradition, faith supported by the evidence of our ancestors in the past. In this way, faith is strengthened by history and the total adventure of man's existence. The second instrument of knowledge is observation, by which we look about us for the immutable workings of universal principles. If we want to look for these principles, we will find them everywhere. If we choose to ignore them, we can, but to our own delay. But whether we find them or whether we ignore them, they operate upon us, and the fact that we try to ignore them has no effect upon their immediate reaction on our lives. The third instrument is experimentation, in which we can set up various processes by which immutable operations of natural law can be verified and justified. These experiments can fulfill the scientific requirement for repeatability and can be performed again and again to demonstrate the absolute consistency of universal processes. In the laboratory, we find that cause and effect inevitably follow each other. And so in various ways, within our means, is possible to become increasingly aware of nature's purpose and nature's omniscience. Yes. We can also gradually become more respectful of nature, realizing that this vast environment in which we exist is worthy of veneration. It is worthy of obedience and the recognition of being the natural leader of all that lives. We are all citizens of this natural commonwealth. We do not make its laws, but we must obey them. We can trust these laws not because they originate in human availability, but because they would exist independent of man's recognition. They are supported by the infinite purposes of life, purposes which are not easily disproven, even when we cannot fully understand them. So natural law becomes the overlord. It is above everything. It is above nations and the unit in United Nations. All things men build must be built in harmony with these things, or they will not live. And nothing which is built in harmony with universal law will actually perish. So instead of believing in harmony with the universal law will actually... So instead of believing ourselves to be castaways, or a little ball in space, which we call the Earth, we are actually involved in, surrounded about, and permeated throughout our entire structure with a network of immutable principles. Law is the intelligence in the body of space. It sees to it that law is the that the will of God is executed, and it is near to us as our breath. It is something that governs every part of our lives. There is not a function in our body which does not operate under law. There is not a mood or emotion which does not produce its inevitable consequences. And every work of art attests to the intelligence which is impregnated in matter. Machines are men's efforts to duplicate and amplify forces already present to nature. To the sensitive man, there is overwhelming proof of universal law, and this proof is the answer to the lawlessness of men. And someday, we shall all face this fact with acceptance. We do not have the right to make rules that are contrary to the purposes of life. Selfishness, indifference, and cruelty can result only in the disintegration of society. Having come to this quiet thoughtfulness, a private citizen can make his own personal pact with universal purpose. He He can try to live on the levels of his own experience in harmony with life, and harmony is an extremely important concept. Harmony means sympathetic vibration to nature. It is working with the plans of things, a plan of things. Harmony means proportion and equilibrium. From observation, we learn that the individual who is harmonious with himself is more apt to have... From observation, we learn that the individual who is inharmonious with himself is more apt to have ulcers. The individual who is angry damages his own health, and how often we see excessive ambition end with an early death. And every time we permit unreasonable conduct to arise in ourselves, we damage our bodies, our minds, and our emotions, and head ourselves into tragedy and misery. Just as surely as this is true in the individual, so it is true in the social commonwealth. Unless society stops breaking the laws of peace and order, it will continue to bring upon itself all the various social ailments from which society can suffer. And it is perfectly possible for a nation to have a coronary. It is perfectly possible for a vast economic project to develop ulcers. It is quite possible for an entire educational system to become neurotic. And wherever rules are broken, trouble is never far. Let our faith be built not on theological premises, but as the insights gained from right conduct and obedience to divine will. It is, we call it divine will because it is infinitely superior to anything we know. Not to respect it, not to venerate it, not to maturely regard it is foolish. For the reward of indifference in these matters is simply sickness. We would probably be more careful if we could somehow experience in advance some of the consequences of our mistakes. If a person in his 20s could know the consequences of his actions upon his body, which he will feel in his 50s, he probably would act with more intelligent use of energy. If a person would experience the pain of a heart attack every time he enjoyed a nice outburst of righteous indignation, few of us would so indulge ourselves. And also, if we could see even for a short period of time at the consequences of our dishonesty in 50 or 60 years, we would all probably be aggressively honest. We do not recognize the certainty of our moral conduct, and by the time these things return to us, we can convince ourselves that we have been singled out for misfortune by some caprice of God. For certainty, or rather certainly, we are not in any way responsible for the events that befall us. And society does what it has always done. It buries its disasters. And the victim complains only for a little while, and then there is silence. The ounce of prevention may be a little late, but the pound of cure still works. And it is time to start working with it. Let us imagine for the pleasure or fun of it, that we are living within a structure of law. Let us be in every respect a good or better as we form of better as any form of law that man can imagine. It is not necessary in order to keep natural law to live below the level of man-made laws. Socrates pointed out very clearly and was unwilling to compromise either. It is not necessary for a person who is better than his society to break the rules of his society. He can live above them, but there is no reason why he should live below them. And thus it happens that integrity still means the most to us. The individual who has never burglarized in all his ancient past does not have the same likelihood of being burglarized as one who has had his conduct in his more recent past. And I sometimes think that we put so many locks upon our doors because we are uncertain that we deserve the things we have, but are unwilling to give them to someone else. The laws of the universe do not have to be broken just because we do not see the justice of things in all instances. If we do not break the rules of natural law, we seldom come into conflict with man-made laws. And as Socrates pointed out, if there is a conflict, then we must do what is essential to the integrity of ourselves and others. Socrates could have saved his life if he had been willing to be part of the face-saving device. His guardians were quite willing to allow him an escape if he would just leave the country and pay a small fine. He refused. He said that if he were to pay a fine, he would be admitting a guilt, which he did not have. And secondly, if he were allowed to escape, he would be breaking the laws of Athens. And while many would say that he was justified by breaking the law, still he would be setting an example of law-breaking, which would cause others to say, wise men break laws, therefore why shouldn't I? Socrates would not allow himself to be an example of lawlessness. He remembered the story of Jesus and the coin with Caesar's face. He said, render unto Caesar that which is Caesar, and unto God that which is God. No one is going to solve his problems by breaking man-made law. Abraham Lincoln knew this, and so did Martin Buber. We can live a life superior to the life required by our society. We can be more honest than the laws demand, because honesty may be a law, but integrity is an attainment within ourselves, and it is integrity which is going to lead us into the commonwealth of the future. We are going to gradually recognize that laws can only inhibit crime, but wisdom can transcend the instinct to crime or violence. And without this moral cultivation, laws do not work, and we are reaching the point where man must rule from within himself. We must simply maintain character, a character which cannot be corrupted. This was the point taken by Confucius, who pointed out that the only human superiority that exists is that which does not permit the individual to corrupt himself or others. It will not allow the individual to live below the level of his own attainment. We're kind of running out of time here, and this is rather long. And I'll try to continue here. This is another 6 or 7 pages. A little bit long to read. So I think I'm going to stop it here. I have to now. We will begin. I'll take this up next week. But it's important to note that what we're reading here tonight is more or less a how to achieve a utopian society, a spiritual society, and that in order for us to get there as a society, we have to put great faith on integrity, great faith on the divine law and the laws of nature, and flow with that law. But remember that its greatest law is that of integrity. We must maintain our integrity at all times, and a conviction to honesty, and a conviction to fair trade, and a conviction to love your neighbor as yourself, a conviction to all of the great philosophies that have come down over the many, many history of man. And with that thought, I'll leave you tonight. I want to thank you for joining me. I hope you join me again next week when we talk about, and this was from Manly Hopkins, Manly B. Hopkins. I don't know if you can get this on the web, actually. I've got an actual book of his lectures. Lecture by Manly P. Hall, Citizens of the Cosmic Commonwealth, Accepting the Leadership of the Divine Will. And we'll stop there tonight. And I want to thank everybody who joined me. I want to thank everybody who's joining me. Thank you. And you can look forward to another show by Lila and myself tomorrow night, when we welcome George Dixon to the show. More insight, more interesting things to talk about regarding the esoteric issues. We like to
touch on those constantly on the show, and we hope that we are gaining an audience as well as containing our audience, and with better and better programming, and that we're that our search becomes your search, and your search becomes ours, as we venture into the unknown worlds of unity consciousness, multidimensional realities, and speak to people of knowledge in those areas, and help help us gain an idea of who and what we are and why we're here and where we're going from here. And we'll be covering that those objects or those aspects of our existence tomorrow night with George Dixon. Hope you can join us. And good night.